This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. 56 years ago today, hundreds of students at Columbia University here in New York started a revolt on campus. They occupied five buildings, including the president's office and Law Library. The students barricaded themselves inside the buildings for a week. They were protesting Columbia's ties to military research and plans to build a university gymnasium in a public park in Harlem. The protests began less than 3 weeks after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. The 1968 Columbia uprising led to one of the largest mass arrests in New York City history. A week into the strike, April 30th, New York City police stormed the campus of Columbia University. Hundreds of students were injured, 700 arrested. Images of the police assault were broadcast around the country. This is a clip from Columbia Revolt by Third World Newsreel.
They got over 700 of us on charges of criminal trespass, resisting arrest, all kinds of other. Some of which was real and some of which was completely fake.
I know of nurses and doctors that pleaded with the police not to proceed, to please let these men alone. And they would say, no, no, that's get away, this is our job.
I was arrested. They would not allow me to see a doctor. I had broken ribs, my face was cut, I got hit with a pistol under the eye, and I was bleeding there, and I wasn't allowed to see a doctor until I got out of court, which was approximately 10 hours later.
But I was awarded a fellowship for next year. What the hell is, I'm sorry. What does it mean? I'm going to strike. But I hope every fact. I don't see how any teacher. I don't see how any student can attend this school anymore. And I was completely liberal about the whole thing. But this bus has radicalized everybody and me very personally.
No, I was a nonviolent student. I was completely passive. I didn't care what happened. I was completely neutral. I'm not neutral anymore. I'll occupy buildings tomorrow.
Yes, folks, it is not Democracy Now!, but that is a relevant historical Democracy Now! Clip to start the show, not least because Juan Gonzalez himself was part of those 1968 protests. David, good to be with you on Left Reckoning. Is it 167?
167, friend. Yes, sir. Happy to be here. We're about to be joined by our good friend Danny Bessner, who put out, I think, the most read story on Harper's ever.
Exciting. Certainly got people talking.
It's got a lot of people talking. It's about the death of Hollywood and taking a strong look at the kind of labor conditions and economic conditions of Hollywood and what that means for people working in the industry and also the rest of us. That's coming up in just a little bit. Always great having Danny on. And as y'all know, you should be subscribed to American Prestige if you aren't already. But Matt, I mean, yeah, you know, you set us up a little bit here with that historical footage. You know, I'm sure we want to talk a little bit more about the protests that we've seen, you know, over this past week since last week's show. You know, I did a pretty long coverage of UT Austin protest on last week's Griscom stream. People can watch that. We'll review some of that stuff later. You know, but there are massive protests all across the country, you know, attempts at encampments, attempts to protest, some of them being met and put down with extreme, extreme violence. I mean, you know, where do you want to start us off here? Because really, you could zoom in a lot of different places to tell the story.
Yeah, I was up late last night listening to the student radio at Columbia, WKCR, do amazing coverage. But just to put into the foreground what needs to be into the foreground, when we speak about, say, campuses, United Nations Human Rights Office of the High Commissioner, after 6 months of military assault, more than 5,479 students, 261 teachers, and 95 university professors have been killed in Gaza, and over 7,819 students and 756 teachers have been injured, with numbers growing each day. Of course, that's just the education-related casualties in a massacre, ethnic cleansing that has killed over 30,000 people at this point, with a invasion of Rafah looming that could drive that into the six figures very easily. According to experts, it's not my estimate, mass graves being found. And also just this Rafah invasion, Bibi has reiterated, not that it's going to be picked up by mainstream media, but that the hostage doesn't matter. He wants to do the killing stuff. The hostages are a pretext for that, and anyone who doesn't come with that understanding is doing a disservice to anybody who's held captive in that part of the world on either side. And so that is the importance here. So that's what these students are drawing attention to by these protests, which have been, you know, it's funny, they moved from Ivy League, these Ivy League, where you had people being attacked, at least all these rich entitled kids, to now they're all over public universities, universities that are supposed to be very public, as you know, in Texas. And also internationally, we've seen that. I just want to also put up what the demands are. The sort of three broad demands are divest, transparency, and amnesty. Columbia University apartheid divestment has a lengthier, more detailed piece here. And I'll just read from this because it's a little bit too text heavy to put up on screen. But first, our demands. The Columbia University apartheid divest demands Columbia University immediately divest all economic and academic stakes in Israeli apartheid in accordance with the result of the 2020 student body referendum. This is a call for democracy, something that people are supposed to value here. Furthermore, we demand that the university call on President Biden, Senators Gillibrand and Chuck Schumer, who both have smeared these protesters, Rep. Adriano Espelat, and all other government officials who support an immediate ceasefire in Gaza in line with the demands of the majority of Americans, to divest from companies profiting from Israeli apartheid, noting that both former Columbia and Barnard presidents unilaterally and anti-democratically ignored the student body referendums to divest in 2020 and 2018. Cancel the opening of the Tel Aviv Global Center, noting that Palestinian affiliates of the Columbia would be restricted from access to this program given Israel's apartheid policies, and further noting that this therefore violates Columbia's very own discrimination policy. Now, I want to stop there as an NYU graduate and just say fuck you to anybody who says it's anti-Semitic to object to things like this, because I was very much against my university using slave labor to build an Abu Dhabi campus at the time, and it wasn't because I was anti-Gulf states, okay? Let's be fucking real here. Cease the dual degree partnership with Tel Aviv University for the same reason. Stop repressing and vilifying pro-Palestinian activism and vigorously protect the academic freedom and right to political speech of students, staff, faculty as they face McCarthyite smear campaigns. Absolutely. Like, that's nothing that he's underlining is whose university is this? It's one thing for you to go over the head. Maybe people might respect that. You have the most respected, prestigious names at your university. I mean, except for the ones who are like, I don't know, Larry Summers or whatever. Rashid Khalidi, Adam Tooze. I mean, I don't even want to start naming them. Rua Benjamin, like, people have put their bodies on the line, actually, to help this stuff. And you're going over the head of it because of funding. Let's be real about what this is. Accordingly, the university must change policies. A protest can be sanctioned within 3 days. And then finally, reinstate Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace and issue an official apology for their unjust suspension violation. That's the other thing, is those groups weren't allowed. That's the first free speech problem here. And guess what happens when you suppress people's speech? From just doing Jewish Voices for Peace or Students for Justice of Palestine, you suppress those groups. This is what happens. You cannot suppress this stuff with force. People will righteously react against it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's probably no better example of that than, you know, what happened here at the University of Texas at Austin. Where people who have seen, you know, some of the horrifying video, you know, last week, I covered this in depth last week, so I won't go over the entire timeline here for everybody. But, you know, last week they had planned for a protest to have a teach-in and a pizza party, you know, bunch of stuff. I'm not saying that trivialized it, just sort of like this kind of big threat that was being put forward by the right and by Jay Harsell, the president of the University of Texas, which is BS. Arrests and crackdowns started within like 40 minutes of the event. Right. It wasn't one of those things that like, oh, it escalated. Things got a little hairy. Because I was saying, you know, if you've been to a lot of these kind of protests and if you've ever been in a protest that where you might have faced police crackdowns, usually what will happen is the police will sort of maybe, you know, create a line, create a kind of situation that's tense, wait for somebody to make a mistake, wait for somebody to throw a water bottle, then they whistle and they come, you know, whatever, you know, try to create an air of tension that they can then use to justify. This was literally students standing at their university, getting together at their university in the public space of their university. And the police immediately cracked down upon it. Now we have had 2 days where there's been tremendous amounts of violence. This is just from, you know, the other day here. Just a little warning, so it will be a little loud. And, you know, the police violence here. there's been 2 days of violence. So there was the big protest last week. And then more people started showing up because that's what people do when they see not only the state brutalizing folks and threatening the right to freedom of speech, but also brutalizing folks in defense of mass murder in Gaza. This is another example of some of the police brutality that we've been seeing here. You see this APD officer beating on somebody who has nowhere to go. And there's more videos like that. We don't need to play the full thing. But like, again, you know, more and more violence. And what has happened? People are more inspired to show up. All right. There's no, you know, this is not going to go away. And one thing that's really interesting about the UT example, and again, not saying this to, you know, talk down on any of the other movements. There were protests all across the state of Texas at universities in Dallas, universities in San Antonio. And you know, there's one that is growing tremendously, and it's the one at UT because of the decision by Greg Abbott, our governor, and the president of the University of Texas system to use brutal police force before anything even started there.
And you know, it's funny because it's like all these protests, whether it's the Vietnam protests, whether it's like that is the record in this country. It's also the recent record. Like I saw somebody make a joke that the Columbia president's following the Hosni Mubarak school of quelling dissent by basically just pouring gas on it.
I mean, 100%. And this is one of those things that where things become really, really clear. You know, I know I did a little bit of this last week, but let me just sort of remind folks of, you know, the way that the free speech question has been sort of talked about at the University of Texas. Because, you know, a lot of these weird guys in power in Texas have been really worried that like strange men can't set up booths on college campuses to harass teenagers. And they made a big deal about it for like the past 6-7 years. You know, about how important freedom of speech is here. Here's the University of Texas actually explaining this policy just a few months back.
Why can members of the public come to campus at any time and engage in demonstrations and speeches?
So state law in Texas actually allows members of the public, just like our university community, to come onto campus and use our common outdoor areas for speech activity. I think that surprises a lot of students. They show up here and they think, who is this random stranger setting up a table talking about a thing I find upsetting? But that's protected by state law, and members of the public, just like university community, can use our common outdoor area.
Yeah, so there you go. You know, that's coming from the university explaining why folks are doing that. And I want to note this for two reasons. Well, actually, let's play this Abbott thing really quick, and then let me add a little bit of context here that's important. Because, you know, here we go.
Some colleges are banning free speech on college campuses. Well, no more, because I'm about to sign a law that protects free speech on college campuses in Texas.
Pulls out his Sharpie.
It almost looks like he's here with us. And he uses a cell phone video like this.
Shouldn't have to do it. First Amendment guarantees it. Now it's law in Texas.
Boom. You know, I mean, we take our freedom of speech very seriously here in the state of Texas. You know, the Constitution protects it, but we're also going to make sure that it's codified. And one of the things that's really interesting about that law, Matt, is it specifically protects the right of non-students to protest at the state's public universities. Because again,
outside agitators.
And I note that for a couple of reasons. One, because look, all this nonsense that we're seeing, you know, is very clearly in violation of all of these kind of precepts and laws that have been passed by Texas's government in the past few years. But two, the university is doing this really cynical thing right now. The university and Republicans are doing this really cynical thing right now. which is trying to treat these protests as outside agitators. And the university is, has been very quick, for example, after the two major days of arrest that we've seen here at the University of Texas, to announce the numbers of how many of the arrestees were students versus non-students, you know, which is trying to drum up support for this point that basically, you know, kind of outside secret organizations are tricking millions of Americans into being against a brutal genocide in Gaza. You know, it's really nasty and cynical stuff that's going on kind of in like the political and media space, you know, on in addition to, again, the brutality in Gaza and also the brutality of these police against against these protesters. But don't believe it for a second when they try to make this kind of weird argument that, yeah, oh, basically a lot of like, you know, secret, strange, dangerous, you know, agitators are coming on the university campuses to create this. No, this is something that has been organized by a lot of really brave folks in the university community, outside of it, because people in Texas, just like people all across this country, don't want to see this stuff done in their name.
Look, when we said free speech, we meant for divorced wife and employee abusers like Steven Crowder to come harass you about how we can lock up Mexicans. We didn't mean people come and criticize the state of Israel, okay?
And you know, and the thing is that like this is not something that came out of nowhere here, by the way. You know, Greg Abbott has been pushing, for example, for universities to accept, you know, ludicrous kind of definitions of anti-Semitism that, you know, define anti-Semitism as criticism of a sovereign nation like Israel. And has also specifically called out groups like Students for Justice in Palestine. You know, that was part of some of his earlier proclamations. So like, this is somebody who has wanted to do this crackdown way before. And just the last thing I'll note on the specific Texas thing before we zoom out is it's also a really, really dangerous example of something that we've been seeing in story after story here in Texas. A lot of these stories that we talk about when we talk about Texas, which is the way that Greg Abbott is using DPS. He is using DPS as his own kind of personal armed forces within the state to brutalize.
Is DPS the Rangers or are those different things?
It's the state troopers. Yeah. Yeah. And so these are the people who he's bringing to the border in Operation Lone Star to brutalize folks at the U.S. border. These are the people who he's calling in to brutalize protesters at the University of Texas system. You know, you're seeing them in photo ops with them. It's a very, very dangerous situation when you have a governor who has basically declared war on a significant part of the population in his state, utilizing the security force in this way. You know, so just an added wrinkle on top of the fact that these people are very happy to take away your democratic rights, whether it be making it more difficult to vote, whether it be using preemption to prevent cities and localities from passing laws in the state of Texas, or in this example, you know, macing and beating up people in a public space for saying we don't want to kill Gazans.
Yeah, I mean, a little gamer reference here from Footlong from Twitch, kind of appropriate for police DPS, name for police DPS damage per second. Yeah, horrible.
And as of course, we've seen what's happened at Emory University, where a lot of those really frightening videos of professors getting beat by the police. Tulane, where we saw some really horrific violence over the week. The thing is that, you know, we have to be able to hold two things at once. Yeah, Utah, absolutely. Where a previous guest of the program, I know, was at that encampment too.
Yep.
And I hope that they're well and safe. Yeah, I mean, the thing is that they can keep on trying to squash this thing. And that's what they try to do here. And that's what they're trying to do at a lot of these other universities. They're really afraid of what comes next. Because the thing is that the demand is so simple. I really, like, you know, it really is clear as day to anybody who's engaging with this, what is happening in Gaza is a mass slaughter, is a genocide. The demand that a ceasefire, that look, the response has been done. Even if you want to operate under, you know, the position of like, oh, they can do a strike back or whatever. That's not my position, but just like that they've sailed right. So far away from even that position that like, yep. It is actually a situation where you either think that it needs to stop now, or you support the wholesale slaughter of all of those people. And they can't put this back in the bottle, and people, the police will continue to beat more protesters. We will see more violence at these protests, unfortunately, from the police or from psychopaths who are getting more and more emboldened by the rhetoric that we're getting from the Republican Party, in addition to the President of the United States himself.
Yep. Right, who's absolutely stoking the flames now. And there are interesting, I think it was Wesleyan University who said, you know, we're actually going to look into this divest stuff instead of sicking cops. It's, wow, like $100,000 Yale police annual salary for Yale cops to go beat up students. It's nice to know what that tuition's paying for. As somebody who's paying not for an Ivy League education at NYU, but for a very expensive one that is the same price as an Ivy League education, it's nice that that money gets to go be used to beat protesters. I love that. I love that.
You know, I mean, what remember this whole thing? I mean, I thought that the universities had been overtaken by radical Marxists. I mean, we're seeing exactly what side of these university systems are on. The people in power, the people of influence, the people who have the ability to do one thing or the other about this are staunch pro-violence, pro-mass slaughter folks. You're seeing this at fancy lefty, quote, lefty universities up north and right here in the South. You know, wow, it's pretty interesting that in America, despite a blue and red state divide, apparently, that the people in power are pretty interested with maintaining their power and seeing the innocent and the oppressed beaten.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's tough to cover these things because they are rapidly developing. Columbia Students for Justice in Palestine, 7 minutes ago, action alert, large NYPD presence on and around Columbia University's campus, strategic resources group known for violent arrests in response to civil unrest is present. Come to campus gates now and stand up for student activists. So if anybody is in the New York area and wants to show up, now's a good time. And also folks who aren't, you know, we'll keep an eye on this too, but into the evening, again, I recommend those student journalists at WKCR are doing really great coverage of this. So,
well, yeah, I think it's like, I don't know, from what I've seen in New York, it does seem like there's going to be more police presence going into it. We, you know, we will try our best to keep y'all, you know, updated on that. I just want to give people some info about what the President of the United States has said about this. This is from NPR's White House correspondent here, who has a statement from Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates. President Biden has stood against repugnant anti-Semitic smears and violent rhetoric his entire life. He condemns the use of the term intifada, as he has the other tragic and dangerous hate speech displayed in recent days.
That would imply that intifada is hate speech. Okay.
Which, for people who don't know, Matt, that is the Arabic word for uprising, if I'm correct.
I mean, it's the same shit my entire fucking life on this stuff. Jihad. Don't say jihad. And you actually look at what jihad means. It's just the Arabic word for struggle or whatever. Like this sort of orientalization of it's scary when it's untranslated. Guess what? If you don't want violent uprisings, don't do an ethnic cleansing and colonization. That's what that's about both intifadas, and nobody that supports the state of Israel and the occupations has a leg to stand on when it comes to justifying fucking violence, because that is what that state and those occupied territories are based on. Like the removal of people violently. So like, I'm sorry, you can be afraid of words like intifada, just like you can be afraid of the ululations in the battle for Algiers. Like you can be afraid of that stuff as you want. Because you know, fundamentally, like it is a threat to a unjust order.
Well, you know, it is. And I mean, this is like, if I've been dancing around it, is the point I've been trying to make, is that the demands here, what we're talking about here, which really, you know, again, is extremely simple. Stop the killing of people in Gaza and listen to the people of the United States of America on this. Right. You know, that is such a dynamic threat to everybody in power. So that's why you have the President of the United States, a Democrat. Remember, we're in a highly divided country, right? the president of the United States of America saying he's against these repugnant anti-Semitic and hate speech, all this kind of stuff. Right. Well, you know who he sounds a lot like? His arch nemesis, you know, and somebody who was supposed to be, you know, destroying the union just a couple months ago. He sounds exactly like Greg Abbott, who tweeted, yeah, arrests being made right now and will continue until the crowd disperses. These protesters belong in jail. Anti-Semitism will not be tolerated in Texas, period. Students joining in hate-filled anti-Semitic protests at any public college or university in Texas should be expelled. It's nice to see, after all of this, you know, partisan bickering in this country, that these folks can come together on their desire to see more brutality against the people of Gaza and against students.
Yeah, it has been very infuriating. I had a point I wanted to make about Robbie Soav. I'll just say, like, I appreciate Bree beating up on him on the Hill. That mother effer. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's a moment of pretty significant clarity. Which on that, Matt, did we want to do the kind of the other little thing we had prepped, or do we want to save that for the post game?
About the student younger. So, yeah, you know, younger generation. It's interesting, like the young Democrats in Virginia, like, have came out with a statement in support of the protests and stuff like that. Like, it's very encouraging when you see certain younger people not taking a careerist path. On the taking a careerist path, look, we do hesitate to criticize some of these people, but this is a path that nobody should be going down. And frankly, Olivia, if you are watching, there's still time to repent this course. But Olivia Giuliano, who got famous for being attacked by Matt Gaetz, you know, it was a despicable person, has since become a kind of Democratic Party apologist and says the Vietnam protest, and then says we're followed by Richard Nixon becoming president, Republicans dominating politics until the 1990s, and Democrats shifting towards hard on crime policies. Y'all want to talk about history, but don't talk about how it fits together. So the thing is like, I guarantee you I've read more history than this girl. And I just want to say, like, you cannot draw that causal kind of link about history, generally speaking. Like, there's probably a lot of determining factors there besides people were upset at this 1968 convention about the Vietnam War. But I have read a lot about that actual time period. And I'll just say this. That lesson is Hubert H. Humphrey should have dropped the fucking loyalty to the sitting president, LBJ. Like, he knew he should have the entire time. And not because Hubert Humphrey was a great guy, but he was politically savvy and he knew that the war was unpopular. Mm-hmm. He could not come out against it because he was vice president to LBJ. And LBJ didn't give him permission to. And guess what? That is the same problem we are facing now, is the guy that that is in power, we all pay fealty to him, even though he should fucking step aside like he said he would. And so, like, yeah, like, if we want to draw lessons, it is don't support these evil fucking conflicts until you drive riots in the American cities. Like, that's good advice.
It really is something that is truly incredible, because, yeah, no, the lesson you should maybe take from that is, like, maybe the Democratic Party shouldn't back mass slaughter and murder of civilians abroad. You know, so anyways, just, like, terrible lesson. And it's also, I mean, this person has been, you know, getting money from the Democratic Party to, you know, be the voice of the youth, which is always very interesting who they select to do that. I would not want to be giving this person money right now, because this is something like that, saying something like that, I can't imagine helps Biden more than it hurts him. But I will also just say that, like, you know, this is a notable one because it is just so egregious, you know, in what's being said here, that, again, you know, the problem here that we're seeing is people protesting against genocide in Gaza, or people protesting against, you know, one of the most horrific American actions, which was the invasion and slaughtering in Vietnam. You know, one that people still are living with the physical consequences of, the genetic consequences of, you know, the sickness that the people of Vietnam still have to deal with because of what we did there. What blood sacrifice is appropriate for these kind of people, you know, that we have to accept keep this fucking party in power, right? Yeah. So, you know, if we don't accept enough killing of innocent people, of women and children all across the world, you know, if you don't accept that, then you might get the Republicans. You know, and like, what is it that we're fighting for in the first place? If what we're saying is that, you know, these fights are really, really important, and they are really important. These fights are so important. Because of what? If these, you know, if we're fighting for democracy, if we're fighting for freedom, we're fighting for a better world. And what we're saying here is that, yeah, we should look the other way as mothers search through the rubble for their children, you know, who have been bombed by Israel with America's backing and blessing. I don't know what it is that we're fighting for. It is the height of cynicism and nihilism to believe something like that.
Like, I think that there can be a tendency to be too dismissive of, say, like Project 2025 or what a Republican administration. But the idea that you are fighting fascism by support, like, I agree that that stuff is so concerning that maybe you should stop supporting a genocide over it, actually, even if it's a ally. Like, I think that, and if you don't, Biden is not serious about that. The class of Democrats who was talking about 2025 and making the decision to keep backing Israel does not give a fuck and actually probably welcomes a period out of time if they can't win their way to let this fascist creep continue. Because guess what? They'll have to deal with less. They'll be able to suppress protests more. They literally do not give a shit. Just like they do not give a shit about like, I'm not saying like the generic party activists. I'm not this misanthropic to think the entire structure is corrupt, but the head is. The head absolutely is. The head sees something like abortion as like, oh, that is just wind in our sails. We're not going to actually do anything. It's going to be good emails for a while. And yeah, go ahead, Dave.
No. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. I was just saying that, like, you know, about that. I mean, you know, the fact is that it is the head that is the issue, and not just, you know, the very top one, but, you know, a bunch of them. You know, but there's a lot of you know, there's a lot of people out there, you know, who get involved in politics, and we live in a really ridiculous country where there's not a lot of political options for folks. You sort of two camps, you know, where people get jobs and start participating in politics. And if you do that, you sort of get forced to make a choice at one point or another, which is say, hey, those kids shouldn't be protesting against genocide because it threatens our electoral chances. Or you say, hey, this is bad, and maybe we should not support genocide, and maybe we should maybe correct course. And you know what happens? You're asked to leave the meeting. And, you know, that is just the fundamental reality in this country, which is why it's really important for us to build movements that can support and sustain each other, so that we can build some power, so that, you know, it is not just the kind of, you know, that having the correct view is not just, you know, something that, like, eventually you're going to have to, you know, make your sacrifice, right? Accept your punishment. We want to be building up movements that can win, so that the freaks who are sitting on top of the system who want to support this kind of slaughter are no longer in power and places of influence.
Yeah, and you know, on that note, let's just give a shout out because we don't just want to tear down here. Yeah. But Gen Z for Change executive director Elise Joshi, who got attacked by Jimmy Dore, people may remember our coverage on this show. But she also did point out that Olivia Giuliani, and people might not be able to see, but she has the Abolish ICE, Black Lives Matter, Free Palestine. Interesting. Well, abolish capitalism, liberate the oppressed in her thing there. So yeah, also vote for Joe Biden
for that, people. Well, yeah, Bidenism, Marxist-Leninism, Bidenism. No, I mean, but for people who were listening, the caption says Olivia in 2021. So the point is that this person who sort of had the door opened to them has gone from abolish capitalism, free Palestine, to, hey, those protesters back in Vietnam, they're sort of problematic because they helped Nixon get elected. It's sort of amazing. It's sort of amazing. And, you know, you do wonder if the dinners and the flights to DC were worth it to do that.
It's sad. It's sad. It's sad because it's like, I mean, imagine if I was just, because like at that age, I was wearing my Richard Dawkins atheist t-shirt. Imagine if someone's like, let's fly this kid out and make him think he knows what the fuck he's talking about. I probably said some wild stuff. And it's just embarrassing what the Democratic Party will turn these young activists into. And so I applaud, you know, Gen Z for Change. And there's others that I've seen, young kids that, you know, I think
Well, because Olivia is completely out of touch with her generation.
Exactly.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's good to see, even groups who you may have thought should have taken a stronger stance against Joe Biden earlier or whatever, like to be like, they see the same world we do. And, mm-hmm. I just appreciate that. But
no, 100%. Well, they're talking about another world that has a lot of barricades and blocks when it comes to careers. Should we switch over to our conversation with Danny Bessner? Danny Bessner, as y'all know, is the co-host of the American Prestige Pod, TMBS Forever Crew, good friend of ours. Y'all should be following Danny if you aren't already. Links below to do that. But this piece in Harper's I thought was really, really great. I highly suggest listening to this interview and then go and read it after, because it was a really, really holistic look at the problem of Hollywood taking a very different kind of track than a lot of those other, a lot of the other analysis goes. So hope you enjoy it. And yeah. Welcome, Left Reckoners. David here, joined by Matt Leck. As always, brother, how you doing?
I'm doing well, David. Good to be with you.
Yeah, man. And we're thrilled to be joined by our good and longtime friend, Danny Bessner. You know Danny Bessner from places like American Prestige, Jacobin Magazine, and most recently from this excellent cover story in the most recent edition of Harper's Magazine. Danny, how you doing?
Good. David, it sounded like you said, instead of welcome, woke-em. So that would be a new greeting.
Well, now that you're big Hollywood, you're bringing the wokeness to the rest of us middle of the country folks. We were just talking about this. I mean, this piece really, captured a lot of attention, and rightfully so. And I want to talk a little bit more in depth about it. But I was just wondering if you think, why you think this sort of struck such a chord with folks, the question of Hollywood and its kind of, perpetual and worsening crisis?
Well, I think it's historically contingent. I think the first basis was that it seems, from what I've gathered, to have really gone around the entertainment industry. And I think that's because it dropped at almost the exact right time. Because the strikes ended in early autumn 2023. And then Hollywood basically goes on break for holidays. So November, December, January are usually very slow periods. And what would normally happen over the last 10, 15 years is that the early months of 2024 would be when a lot of studios and streamers bought shows, and it would be when they staffed writing rooms. I think what's happened this year, as I had long been predicting since I began research for the article, is that there's been a broad contraction. So I think a lot of the people who came to Hollywood during the Gold Rush era were now for the first time, really the post-Gold Rush era. So a lot of people aren't working. And so I think it sort of spread like wildfire through Hollywood because it provides an explanation as to why this year is different than other years. So that's why I think it did well in Hollywood. And then I think it did well more broadly because it speaks to what everyone in the creative industry is going through. I think it speaks to what happened in journalism, which is, I believe, very similar in terms of private equity and the entrance of hedge funds and asset management companies into journalism. Even though I haven't studied it in depth, my understanding is that a similar process occurred. And also in academia, which is subject to different pressures, but in which it's been very difficult to make a life as an academic. So I think it broadly resonated with people who wanted to have creative careers, and also just in general, people care about Hollywood in a way they don't care about, let's say, foreign policy. So I think that those are the three major reasons why it seems to have struck a chord.
Well, I mean, again, people really should read the piece because, it goes into, I think, a lot of like the kind of political economy of like how Hollywood functions and the role of, creative labor here. And I wanted to sort of maybe to get us into it a little bit is I think, there's oftentimes these kind of conversations are almost all technology based, right? It's sort of like, oh, the technology has changed and therefore the conditions have fundamentally changed. And no doubt about it that the streaming services have sort of changed how Hollywood operates, how TVs are made, how movies are made, all that kind of stuff. But what do you think that kind of like pop perspective that, oh, the technology has changed, therefore, Hollywood is in trouble. What would that be missing?
So I'm actually trying to look up the exact quote. It's either from Walter Lippmann or Harold Laswell. And one of them basically likened propaganda to a pump, which is that the tool itself is neutral. It's how you use the tool that matters. And that's just true, I think, broadly for all technology. There's a world where you could, you know, do streaming services and people are actually well remunerated. It's probably not the hyper-capitalist neoliberal world that we have, but there is, you know, there is a world where that happens. And so technology is basically, I think there, this is a complicated, almost philosophical question, because I think technology sometimes does exert independent causal force in the world, but I would say most of the time it doesn't. Most of the time it is interacting in a social space where it could be used in a variety of ways. And so streaming services in theory could have been a boon to writers, that you could have gotten the exciting, daring programs that I think did genuinely define the streaming era, or at least programs that wouldn't have necessarily been greenlighted in previous eras. You know, I start the episode talking about Dickinson, which is just like a show that wouldn't have been greenlighted in 1995, or another show I mentioned, I Love Dick, based on a small press. That's a Texas book, right, David? It's a Marfa book, I think. Basically, so like those shows would have never been made. So you could imagine a world where you get the benefits of streaming, which is more writers employed on interesting shows without the drawbacks, which is the writers are employed for fewer amounts of times, don't get residuals, and don't have the basic structure that had been developed in the, you know, the previous decades of WGA negotiation. So I think technology, again, sometimes can exert independent causal force. Like the atomic bomb creates new realities just by being the atomic bomb. So there is some sort of object-oriented ontology there. But for the most part, the atomic bomb is meaningful insofar as it exists in a world in which nations fight each other. And I think a similar thing could be understood about streaming, is that it's a technology, and technology could be used to different purposes.
Yeah, well, I mean, just so we're clear for people, I just want to establish this really quick, Matt. Like when we're talking about the crisis, I know we're, you know, there's an aspect of it about, you know, what that's meaning for writers and creatives. But what, I mean, what do we mean when we're saying like Hollywood is a crisis? Is it just sort of like the industry and the people who work in it aren't doing as well as they should be? Or are we also trying to say like the quality and what's out there is like going down?
Yeah, so I didn't comment on the quality because I do think it's very difficult to make big sweeping claims about quality. It's not like everything in previous eras of Hollywood was so great. Most art is shitty. Almost always, most art is bad. So I think it's almost a fool's errand to talk about quality, except insofar when you could point to the material conditions that allowed greatness to be achieved. So if you think about The Sopranos, run by David Chase, The Wire, run by David Simon, I think Simon co-ran it, Breaking Bad, run by Vince Gilligan. These are TV veterans. These are people who had spent decades in the TV trenches. You know, David Chase was on a bunch of shows. David Simon had done Homicide. Vince Gilligan had famously been writing for The X-Files, I believe. So they had, you know, been trained and reproduced by an industry to the point where things opened up creatively and financially for a variety of different reasons in the late 90s and 2000s, because they knew so much about television, because they had been reproduced by the industry, they were able to make wonderful art. And I think that is less likely to happen given the state of the industry in the late 2000s and into the 2010s. And another thing to emphasize is that I wasn't able to get into this so much in the piece, but this is sort of the dialectic of capitalism, because when deregulation first happened in the 1980s, there was initially a boon for writers, both screenwriters, writers of film and television, because really deregulation, it's very complex and it kind of goes back and forth, but deregulation allows for the rise of a bunch of cable stations. And cable is really where you first get prestige TV with The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, The Wire, and still really cable and streaming are the sources of prestige TV. But over time, capitalism does what it does, and it eventually, as the profit rate falls, needs to find new ways to cut costs and new places to invest. So Hollywood was that new place to invest, and the costs were labor, as usually happens. Labor is usually the first thing that's cut. But I also think the piece resonated because I think a lot of junior executives and creative executives, what I call the humanities majors, understand that this is coming for them too. more costs need to be cut after the writers have been cut and the talent has been cut. And it's probably going to be younger executives, and it's probably going to be the executives with humanities degrees who do things like develop projects and contribute to story. So I think people understand that something is happening here, and it's not in the interests of humanity.
Yeah, can we talk about a little bit the Golden Age and how this was related to, like, how these companies were selling themselves to Wall Street, for instance, at a sort of post-recession period?
No, next question. No, just kidding. So what happened was that, so there's the dot-com crash in 2001. And this is, tech was really the space that large financial firms who had been deregulated over the course of the 80s and 90s wanted to invest. But the dot-com crash and the subsequent almost monopolization of tech with the big firms like Facebook and Google and Amazon made tech ultimately not as inviting a place to invest as it had been during the first dot-com boom of the 1990s. So there's finance looking for places to invest in the 2000s. Then you have the Great Recession. And in response to the Great Recession, the federal government pumps, I believe it's $7.7 trillion of capital into the financial system, and also famously starts lowering interest rates, making interest rates eventually approach number zero. I don't actually believe it's ever zero, but it approaches zero, from what I remember of looking into it. So you have money and access to cheap credit in the system after 2008, and you have five finance looking past tech for places to invest. Because Hollywood's not necessarily the greatest place to invest. It's a business that is, first of all, based on hits, so that's a lot of losses. It's a business that, generally speaking, has relatively low marginal returns, and it's a business that's ultimately unquantifiable. The famous quote that I use in the piece and that everyone knows that William Goldman says is, no one knows anything. It's based on taste, it's based on reading what an audience wants, so it's very difficult to predict. Nevertheless, because there are fewer places to profitably invest in this country since the 1970s and deindustrialization, finance comes into Hollywood. And so when finance comes into Hollywood, the company that takes the smartest advantage of it is Netflix. And, you know, you got to hand it to Netflix. They really made the right play. They were good business people. They have successfully become a profitable, very profitable company, from my understanding. And they were able to basically entirely disrupt the entertainment industry. And the history of entertainment is famously littered with businesses that come in and they're like, we're going to disrupt Hollywood. And everyone's like, yeah, okay, we'll take your money, but see you in a few years on your way out. Netflix actually did it. Netflix actually destroyed the cable business. all in the service of a monopoly play, much like Amazon and Uber were monopoly plays. The idea was you get subscribers or users. In streaming TV, it was subscribers. In Uber, it was users. In Amazon, it was users, with the goal being that you'll lose money for several years, but nevertheless, Wall Street will fund you because eventually you'll be the only service. You'll be the monopoly. Netflix will be TV, just like Amazon is basically business in the United States. I think so many businesses have collapsed and have failed and have not even gotten off the ground because Amazon could just undercut them. Uber and Lyft famously destroyed the taxi business. So that was the play that Netflix made. And the other companies starting around the mid-2010s thought that that was the future. So that they began to found their own streaming services, that they began to rely on their own intellectual property. You know, you have over the next few years, Max, what's it called? WB Warner Brothers, which becomes Warner Brothers Discovery, has HBO Max, which eventually becomes Max. Disney has Disney Plus. Comcast has Peacock. And there are other streaming services in there. ESPN, Tubi, whatever have you. But the problem is that not every company can be a monopoly play. And so you have an industry that is constantly losing money with the idea that there'll be the monopoly, which is not going to happen. And this basically keeps on continuing. There are more people coming out to Hollywood. It's like a typical gold rush structure until early 2022, where two things happen. The Fed starts raising interest rates. And in April 2022, Netflix announces that it lost subscribers and it planned to lose 2 million subscribers in the coming months. And I believe they never lost that much, but that's what they thought. So that is the moment when all the stock prices of Netflix and the company's share prices begin to collapse. And they really lose a lot. And they, my understanding, last time I checked, they're still not up to the levels they were before April 2022. But anyway, Wall Street calls in the bet, which is that you're now going to be, you're going to have to become profitable in some meaningful way. So that is the first moment of a new post-streaming era in Hollywood, which is then, and through, I think, the writers and SAG, the actors, SAG-AFTRA, did exactly what they needed to do by going on strike. This comes after COVID. Then you have the great Netflix correction, as it's called, in April 2022, and then you have the strikes. So this really put a pause on new business in the industry. And like I said, the idea in Hollywood, it's funny, after being there for a bit, it's a, really a town that runs on gossip, and everyone kind of has gossip that's delivered from the capital side to the agents, and then the agents tell the talent, and they, everyone kind of repeats it, and there's a phone, telephone, but people really thought that the business was going to restart early 2024. I did not think that would happen, because if you just look at the macro economy, it just really can't happen. This is going to be I think it's going to be a bloodbath. I was saying, you know, from my understanding, you know, roughly 30% contraction. I think it might even be more at this point. So there's going to be a collapse of this industry, which just mirrors what happened in journalism. This is something that you could see happening in other industries. Industries could die if they're not regulated or protected by forces like the government. And Hollywood certainly is not. And that is basically where we find ourselves today. The also the question that, just to end, that is truly still open, is to what degree do these streamers need new content? And they really continue to maintain growth or maintain relative stability if they kind of just show friends forever? They'll definitely need new content, but I think the business side is starting to conclude, probably correctly, they don't need that many new shows. That probably a lot of their shows aren't watched because, again, Hollywood is a business of hits. So there are these general transitions and these general contractions that are having that are really going to affect labor, which is why I ended the call. Actually, I think I ended, I'm not sure if I even wrote this in the piece, it's hard to keep track now, but I was just on Fresh Air and NPR, and I ended with there needs to be a general strike. And I still think that's really the only way that you're going to get a relatively healthy industry.
Well, I mean, before we get into like the ways to deal with it, I think that like one of the things that's really important about your piece here is that, you know, I mean, yeah, because like there's an aspect of the streaming stuff where like there was almost like an overproduction. You sort of know how like there was just like a lot of shows getting greenlit for a few years, and then that has just markedly declined. And then, you know, what that has led to is, you know, there's this issue when it comes to labor. And I was just wondering if you could paint a little bit of a picture here. You know, you write about what these things called mini rooms, which are these kind of short, you know, periods where people are writing that they don't see the project finish. You know, you talk about the insecurity of most writers. And, you know, if you could talk a little bit about that, and I think it'll be important for us too, once we get to the labor aspect, you know, to help our audience, because when we cover the strike, you know, we get the same comment as I know you've heard a million times. Why are we so concerned with, you know, the careers of rich kids? You know, these are all, you know, fancy kids who are well off and make a lot of money being TV writers. I mean, could you sort of talk about the experience of labor, the decline there, and also like what that daily life is like for folks, despite the kind of public perception?
Sure. Well, first of all, that wasn't always true for Hollywood. That's really only been true in the last 10 plus years when our economy has become increasingly unequal. And that Hollywood reliance on unpaid internships, very low paying assistant jobs, and of course, family connections is really a place right now where you have to have some sort of financial stability to basically buy the lotto tickets, which wasn't always true. In the past, if you broke in, you were still able to make a relatively successful career, which I don't think is necessarily true now. You have to keep on breaking in after you broke in, which has been true for, let's say, 20 years, but wasn't true 50 years ago, what have you, because we lived in a Fordist economy. But anyway, traditionally, when you were employed on a television show, you know, think of the shows of the 1990s, Law and Order, obviously that lasted much longer. But let's say you're on Law and Order. It's a 22 episode season. You're employed for roughly 8 months. You write one or two episodes, which means if you were above the lowest level of writer, you got script fees, which is kind of wild. Lowest level writers wouldn't get script fees until the new agreements. So that's good. But you would get a lot of money and you would get residuals. when it was rebroadcast, when Law and Order is rebroadcast everywhere. So that would provide a basis for you if you didn't work for a year or two, because it's very difficult to get a job in Hollywood, a writing job in Hollywood. You were employed for a longer time, you were making more money, and more importantly, when I was talking about the industry reproducing itself, you would do things like go to set. You would go to set, and you need to go to set, because if you're a writer and you eventually want to be a showrunner, because that's what you would advance to, writers are showrunners in television, you would need to learn how to talk to an actor. You would need to learn how to talk to a director. You would need to learn how to stay within budget. You would need to learn how to talk to a line producer. So one of the things that the industry was doing by employing people for longer amounts of periods and allowing them to go to set was it was allowing itself to reproduce itself. So what happens with deregulation and financialization is that there is now incentives to cut costs. So one of the ways that initially cable companies like AMC and Starz were trying to compete with bigger cable companies like HBO and, of course, the broadcast networks was that they would convene mini rooms as what they're now officially called development rooms, literally to develop shows. You know, you're not necessarily sure you want to put a show into production, so you hire four people to work for 10 weeks to break a season of story, to literally just come up with this what the story for a season is going to be. And then the room is dispersed. And those people who work in those 10 week or so rooms, that's probably the average, even though some rooms could be as short as 4 weeks, were as short as 4 weeks. After those 10 weeks, you would go and you would try to find another job, and you'd never get one, the long-term experience of working in a room, or two, the experience of going to set. So by cutting the cost of labor, by not employing people for as long, you wind up not reproducing the industry over time. And so I think this is what happened over the course of the late of the 2010s, probably starts around 2013, 14, 15, gets worse and worse and worse over the late 2010s into the early 2020s, which is one of the main reasons there was a strike.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, it's a really bleak picture. And I mean, you know, you talk about the strikes and it was very inspiring. But I mean, one of the things that, you know, was sort of difficult in your piece is sort of saying that, like, it doesn't seem like the strikes were able to solve this kind of fundamental contradiction here.
No, I think that you can't expect any hearing to necessarily, sorry, any hearing, any negotiation or union deal to necessarily fix the structural problems, especially a strike that was, I mean, it was, people have called it a dual strike, but they were negotiating separately. So no union or any one strike could be expected to solve the profound structural problems of the industry. So that's why I think you need to have more radical action. Otherwise, it's just going to continue to degrade.
Yeah, I know. Go ahead, Matt.
It sounds, you know, you mentioned journalism, and that seems like an obvious parallel, but also like Boeing, it seems like just the way people who know how to do things are getting edged out by business concerns. Like, this seems sort of endemic, broadly speaking.
I think that's right. And I think that capitalism essentially isn't working. You know, like, even according to the capitalists, I mean, one would think according to the capitalists, it's just focused on entirely short-term profit, and it's incredibly destructive. You know, it's no longer creative destruction, it's just destruction. This is just the destruction of an industry. There's nothing really emerging in its place. So obviously at this point, capitalism has arrived at a perverse place in its history. And I think that's evident in things like Boeing and also in the entertainment media writ large.
I mean, Lord, you saw this like Musk thing recently. I don't know if you saw the Cybertruck recall. But the goddamn pedals aren't bolted onto the, you know, onto the truck, meaning that they could slide out and the accelerator could get stuck. And, you know, that's just something that happens when you basically force out most of your design team and create this kind of super crazy environment, right? And it's, again, it's like, that's to placate ownership. That's to placate management. Usually capital is at least a little bit more vicious, and it's just sort of about making money versus Tesla, which is also like, I want to make money and also like make our boss happy, but.
They don't really make money in the traditional way. They can make money through effectively financial manipulation. So it's not like buy for a dollar, sell for two. Like, I believe that was Proposition Joe from The Wire who said like that. That's like traditional capitalism, but that's not what financial capitalism is. Financialized capitalism is effectively mystification and magic. These are not real companies linked to real things that are happening in the world. It's just making money off of money. It should be mega regulated. And it's not, I mean, it shouldn't even be allowed, but it's not. And so you get these perverse incentives.
You're saying when Elon Musk tells me that if I spend $100,000 on a giant wagon, that it's not actually going to be able to go become a robotaxi and earn me money passively sometime down the line? Like, is that some kind of mystification?
I hate to say that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things that I really liked in your NPR piece, in your NPR interview, and what we've sort of talked about before this, is that, like, you know, we can talk about Hollywood, or we can talk about a lot of different industries, but it is like this kind of just weight of finance capital that has, you know, completely dominated American capitalism. And like, as a historian, you know, I mean, how, like, you know, unique is this in the history of American capitalism? Because, like, you know, we can think of like the big monopolies back in the day and things like that. But this one, I mean, this stuff is really extreme, that it's sort of touching not just kind of like certain industrial industries, but like, yeah, like the TV shows that I'm watching, or hell, I mean, Matt and I have done a lot of stuff on the video game industry, which is also dealing with the kind of crazy issues in kinds of, in terms of consolidation. I mean, you know, are we going to get to a point where these things, where these like kind of financial firms have run out of things to gobble up, or is it just something that might be like kind of perpetual cycle of them, you know, constantly just like breaking down industry after industry?
I mean, I don't think there's likely, I mean, if I was just looking at the situation, I don't think there's likely to be regulation. It's a pretty grim mm-hmm. moment. I don't know, maybe when the gerontocrats who run the society die, there'll be slightly more progressive takes on antitrust and monopolization. That might be. I think we'll have to wait, but I don't think that's coming in the next 4 years, given whether Biden, let alone certainly if Trump wins, it's not coming. And it doesn't seem likely under Biden either.
But I mean, do you think antitrust is enough for, I mean, not just, you know.
Yeah. No, it's antitrust, and you'd have to seriously regulate finance, and you'd have to seriously regulate all of these industries. Antitrust mm-hmm. isn't enough, and people only talk about it like antitrust because it's kind of legible. Americans understand how monopoly is bad. It prevents competition. But you have this beast of finance that, you know, the three asset management companies own the largest stakes in 88% of the S&P 500. It should simply not be allowed. You know, mm-hmm. that even under under capitalism, that shouldn't be allowed. That's just total preventing of competition. Obviously, there are perverse incentives that are implied when the same three gigantic, you know, companies own so much. So you also need to regulate finance, and you'd really need to regulate private equity. You really need to regulate hedge funds. You need to regulate corporate venture capital. So it's not just antitrust like it was in the 1910s. It's much more complex now, much more financial. And again, this is mystified, and it seems more complicated than it is. It boils down to fake money makes fake money. But, you know, if you throw a bunch of numbers at people, they get mystified, and it's confusing, and it's difficult to understand how these swaps work, and it's difficult mm-hmm. to understand basic things like what is a short. And so it also prevents people from doing the regulation. Moreover, the type of regulation that has been accomplished, like by someone like Ralph Nader, is very focused on this idea of American consumption, and that the consumer is the actor in American capitalism. So we'd also have to kind of move away from a consumer-focused capitalism, because in fact, deregulation was at the time justified by being, because it was better for the consumer, by in the short term leading to lower costs. Though obviously now, when everyone's paying for, going to pay for, or supposed to pay for six streaming services, it's going to happen. It doesn't actually work out like that in the long run.
Well, Danny, the last question I want to ask you before you go is part of joke and part serious. You know, is the problem with Hollywood and media that they went woke and they went broke?
No, it's so funny. It occurred concurrently, mm-hmm. But I don't think they were necessarily causally interrelated. I think that Hollywood is a liberal town. Sort of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and quote-unquote wokeness, was primarily a liberal project. So it's not surprising that it took off in Hollywood, because it is not necessarily connected to the redistribution of wealth. And so you have a diversification of gender and people of different sexualities and gender identities, and there's more female writers, there's more writers of color, and from what I read from the WGA, there was a substantial increase in that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, again, this is anecdotal because I couldn't find numbers on the class composition of Hollywood, but my understanding is that the class composition remained relatively elite. Mm-hmm. So you have gender, sexual, and racial diversification, while class diversification is not really... didn't really happen. But I ultimately think that wokeness, except insofar as people could look at it, did it spur a lot of hit shows? But is that really against wokeness? I mean, most shows aren't hits. Most shows don't do well. So I don't think that's necessarily due to wokeness. You could look at the 90s. They did shows based on comedians after Seinfeld. You know, like Greg Giraldo's show was canceled. Chris Titus's show didn't last very long. Most shows are bad. Most shows don't last long. And I don't think that's unique to wokeness or 90s comedians. I think that's just true for most art.
Well, do you think a lot of the less of those kind of things, you know, and obviously, like, when we talk about, like, shows being woke, you know, there's a broad spectrum of, like, you know, fantasy and
there's definitely decreased interest in Hollywood from everyone I've talked to.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah, it seems like that.
And I think that's due to a lot of different reasons, but that era seems to be, from everyone I spoke with, decidedly over, to the mm-hmm. degree where executives are saying things like, we don't want shows about Latinos.
Okay. Right?
Like, we're not green lighting shows like that any longer. Mm. So what Hollywood does, it's a trend chasing town. There's whiplash because creators who were working in a particular sphere and who were, for the first time in Hollywood's history, not marginalized, are now not as sought after as they once were. From my reporting, from my interviews, I don't have data to point to. But in 5 years, the WGA, I imagine, will do some sort of study and we'll see what happened. And my guess is that there's going to be fewer shows that center on people of color. There are going to be fewer shows that center on gender and sexual minorities, and there's going to be a return to what is imagined as the mean, which is white, cis, straight people. That is my guess. I'd be very surprised if that didn't happen, but we will remain, I mean, remains to be seen.
Well, Danny, really appreciate you taking the time to join us again on Left Reckoning, and the piece is excellent. Y'all can find it in the May issue of Harper's. There'll be links below. American Prestige as well. Y'all better be subscribed to that. You guys better subscribe to that a long ass time ago, but get on if you haven't. Danny, is there anything else we can point folks to?
No. If they want to, for some reason, you could follow me on Twitter at @dbessner.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Danny.
Go woke, go broke.
Always good to talk to Danny.
No,
Hollywood Danny B.
Yeah, Hollywood Danny Bessner. You know, he's a fancy guy now. No, I mean, hell, he, you know, he's writing about Hollywood. He's going on Bill Maher. What's next?
And it's not actually like, we didn't even plug his original book, A Hans Speer and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual, but there's actually a lot of culture industry stuff in that book as well.
100%. And also in his the Michael Brooks Show days too. I don't know what the final number was, but you know how he hit that Harper's record for how much people love that and read that piece. He also hit a TMBS record, I think, for one of our most watched videos ever, when we did the video about Call of Duty. I can't remember what the title of that one was, but it was Call of Duty something. Funny. And it just, you know, it did monster numbers too. So, you know, Danny's not a one hit wonder, is all I'll say. Yeah. So
he's a hit maker.
Should definitely be following him. And, you know, Matt and I will be spending a lot of time with him, hoping we get invited to the next big thing. But
Biden parties.
The next big thing is coming right around the corner. It's called The Postgame. Postgame 167, Our Heavenly Fathers. We have a fascinating new introduction to Christian theology that Matt and I are going to be investigating. You won't want to miss it. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get access. There's one more thing I wanted to get to, though, before we jump over there, and that's just a quick announcement of something that y'all should be supporting, particularly if you're in the Austin area, a really exciting opportunity. I can share this flyer. I don't know how legible it will be, but if you're in the Austin area and you are a musician, the Austin Federation of Musicians is doing their union membership drive right now. There are, I'll put a link in the show notes for people to be able to join. But from now until June 30th, if you join the union membership drive, both your local and federation initiation fees will be completely waived. This means that new members can join the musicians union for only the cost of membership dues. You know, this will save you some money. So if you're an Austin musician listening to this program, definitely join the union and do it now so that you can take advantage of this union drive. Again, I mean, you know, everybody deserves a union, and particularly the musicians in the city who have created so much joy and culture and meaning in all of our lives deserve a union, as there's a lot of attempts to make it more and more difficult to be a working musician. And Austin is a working musician town, and we never want to see that go away. And the union is an important shield and tool for people to be able to fight to make sure that not just in Austin, all across the country and all across the world, that the people who create joy and meaning in our life are able to have food on the table and healthcare and get treated fairly by venues and ticket companies and all of that. So definitely try to take advantage of that union drive. I'll put a link below for folks, and I'll put it in the chat right now for people who are watching live.
And also Autumn Leaves says, Matt, react to the Kendrick response in 5 words. the Kendrick response is greatness.
Matt, you need, man, you need to be doing that in the post game. As a teaser. Anyways, folks, jump over there, patreon.com/leftreckoning, to support the show and get access to the post game plus the Sunday show. You won't want to miss this week's one. Last week's was a lot of fun, and yeah, got good things cooking up. So patreon.com/leftreckoning, join us. Thanks everybody for hanging out with us. See you soon.
Peace.